Good afternoon. Welcome to the Peter Mac Show. Thanks for tuning in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. I'm your host, Peter McCandless, and today is May 19th, 2007. My guest on the line with me today is George Taylor. He's the state climatologist for the state of Oregon, and we're going to be discussing, as you might have guessed from my choosing him to be a guest, global warming and climate change in general. So, George, if you're there, thank you for taking time out of your Saturday to come on the Peter Mac Show.
My pleasure, Peter. Good to talk to you.
Great. Well, there are several questions we might just throw out for the listeners, and then we can approach those as time permits. And I'll just go through some of these in no particular order. But one would be, you know, are we in fact experiencing climate change in a more general sense than global warming? And what is causing that? Are human beings in fact causing that? If human beings are in fact causing that, which, excuse me, what should be done about it? So maybe we should just start at the beginning and talk about climate change. Are we in fact experiencing climate change?
Oh, absolutely. We are experiencing it. In fact, climate changes all the time on a variety of scales. Of course, it changes seasonally, winter and summer. It changes within the seasons at shorter terms, and it changes on annual and decadal, multi-decadal, century scales, millennial scales, and so on. So, yes, climate is always changing, and it always will.
Okay. Now, in the last, I know here living in Kansas City, since I moved back from Florida in 92, that the lakes have not frozen in the winter like they used to when I was a kid. We used to be able to ice skate on the lakes the first couple weeks of January, and to the best of my knowledge, in the last 15 years or so, that has not taken place. So it does seem that the winters are more mild here in general, although this last winter was more typical of what I experienced as a child. Is that part of a relatively short trend, do you think, or a longer trend, or is it possible to tell what kind of trend we're in at this point?
Well, you know, there are a lot of aspects to that question, Peter, that I'll try to address briefly. First of all, our memories and our perceptions are often very very imperfect indicators of what's actually happened.
Sure.
We tend to remember events and often have a difficult time making them really objective memories. So I tend to rely more on actual numbers when I look at temperatures and precipitation, snowfall, and so on. Having said that, I will acknowledge that the 50s, 60s, early 70s were generally a much cooler period than we're seeing now in pretty much all parts of the U.S. and in many parts of the world. Those were cool decades, with the 60s being arguably the coolest of all. So if you establish a trend beginning, let's say, in 1960 to right now and sort of plot all the trends on a piece of paper, you're going to have an upward trend over that period of time, without a doubt. Yes, the climate has changed since 1960. But if you go back a little bit farther in time, if you go back to the 30s, the late 20s, the early 40s, you come upon a period that's comparable to what we're seeing now, arguably warmer, depending on where you're really looking. In the Pacific Northwest, the warmest period of the last 100 years was the 1930s.
Okay.
So if you start your trend in the 1930s, you'd say, well, it cooled and then it warmed somewhat, but my plot looks like the letter U, you know, kind of a real broad letter U, or shaped like a soup bowl, I guess, with a low point in the bowl being in the 1960s. So okay. In this case, probably your perception of the lakes freezing over in the 60s was accurate, but if you go back a little bit farther, you get a different answer.
Okay, so at least in the last, say, 70, 80 years, we've experienced one warming trend sometime in the 30s and then some cooling down around the 60s, and then sometime thereafter in the 70s, it started warming up again, right?
Correct.
Okay, but as you said, in the Pacific Northwest, the warmest period in the last century was in the 1930s. So even if we're experiencing a warming up, we haven't gotten as warm, at least in that part of the country, as we did in the 30s, right?
Correct. We're pretty comparable to what we were then, but not really significantly different. And I think that tends to be true pretty much nationwide. The nationwide average right now is about a quarter of a degree Fahrenheit higher than it was in the late 30s and early 40s. So a quarter of a degree is pretty small.
Right. Okay. Now, of course, what we've been hearing in the news for the last 5 years, 10 years or so, and sort of culminated here recently with Al Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth, is that we are experiencing not only a warming up, but a disastrous warming up, and this is going to have disastrous consequences for the planet. And, you know, some folks like Al Gore and others, I think, are making the case that this is due, if not exclusively, at least largely due to human activity, namely the burning of fossil fuels. And I know that when we talked before, there are a number of scientists have varying opinions on that issue. Maybe you could just sort of tell what your opinion is on that question and sort of where you fit along the continuum of various scientists, various climatologists on that question.
Okay. Yeah, I'll make this very generalized and very brief because obviously I could talk all day on this subject and some people
have.
I don't think we have 8 hours for this conversation.
Okay. Well, we have 2 hours, so take
care. Okay. Well, and that's actually pretty long. This is the key question, and the question is, do human activities affect climate, and if so, by how much? And I think just about everybody agrees that human activities do affect climate. So it becomes a matter of degree and to what degree that is. There are people that do say that virtually all of climate change is due to human activities, and I take strong issue with that. There are some that say humans have no effect on climate, and I take issue with that as well. So I'm in between those two, but I tend to be down on the minimalist side of the human influence. I don't deny the human influence, but I believe that natural variations have been and continue to be a bigger influence on climate change than do human activities. And when it comes to human activities, there are quite a few things in addition to greenhouse gases that can influence climate. So I think that in many ways, human-induced greenhouse gases are overly credited with changing climate, both compared to other human activities and certainly compared to natural variations. I really think that natural variations dominate the climate system.
Okay. And if we go back to the 30s, if that indeed was the warmest period, at least for some parts of the country, if the emission of fossil fuels, residuals from there is causing it, then you would expect, it seems to me, a gradual increasing. I mean, if we had a gradual increasing in the number of cars, probably a steady increase from, you know, the invention of the automobile in the early 1900s and up until now, there are more and more cars on the planet probably every year. And one would expect, if that were the case, that you wouldn't have had this cooling period during the 60s if that were the primary cause of the change in the climate, right?
Oh, that's correct. And if you go back, let's just say going back 100 years and looking at CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere and comparing that with temperatures, for the period from 1900 to about 1920, there was a very small increase in CO2 and virtually no change in temperatures. Temperatures were relatively cool during that period. Beginning in about 1920, the temperature started to go up, and they went up pretty fast. And we ended up in that very warm decade in the 30s, peaking in the late 30s and early 40s. And yet CO2 really didn't go up much at all. The CO2 concentrations really started to go up during World War II, when there was such massive industrialization that was related to the war effort. And so beginning in World War II and continuing until now, we've seen a steady rise in CO2. However, as you've just pointed out, for the first 30 years of that period, the temperatures actually dropped. And the real concern in the 70s was the temperatures had been falling for 30 years, and if those trends continued, then we were likely to see a disastrous set of years that would especially harm agriculture. Historically, cold periods have been in many cases dangerous or hazardous or devastating for society because they really have a negative influence on agriculture, whereas warmer periods have tended to be more beneficial. But anyway, during the period from the 40s through the mid-70s, CO2 went up and temperatures went down. And there were people that wrote books suggesting that the reason the temperatures were going down was because of human activities, especially dust and other things that are called aerosols.
Mm-hmm.
Then beginning in the mid-70s, temperatures started to go back up again. And And during the period over the last 25 years or so, at least for the first 25 years of that period, temperatures went up and CO2 went up. So this was the only period in the last 100 years when temperatures rose and CO2 rose at the same time simultaneously. The temperatures, by the way, peaked in 1998 during the big El Nino, and they've in many places gone down since then or leveled off on a global basis. So it's not true that temperatures continue to rise in a steady manner. They have certainly either leveled off or actually gone down a lot since 1998.
Okay. Let's go ahead and take a call. We have John on the phone. John, go ahead. You're on the Peter Mac Show.
Hello?
Go ahead. Yes, we can.
Yes, I just stepped outside because I was near the radio. There are a couple of things that I think you might find interesting. I heard a gentleman this week on Joyce Riley's program. His name was A.C. Griffith. Have either of you heard of him before?
A.C. Griffith?
Right.
No, I haven't.
Well, he had very high clearance in the government and with the CIA, too, and he was talking about all of the technology that was developed in Russia with the Tesla technology, and he was really commenting on some really powerful issues. He says he had to come out and talk about it in regards to weather control and also powerful things that can be done with this technology. So he even tied in the shuttle that was taken out of the sky with this technology, and he says there's an EMF, I think it's EMF, umbrella over every city. It was very interesting. If you can go back on our show program from last week and look at A.C. Griffith. Also, Scott Stevens. Have you heard of Scott Stevens?
No.
From WeatherWars. He's a meteorologist. His website's WeatherWars.info. His claim is that all weather is controlled at the present time with that technology. Okay. With the chemtrails and the powerful electronic EM electromagnetic impulses that they can put through these. So I just like to throw that out there, and if you can do some research on these gentlemen, I think you'll find some very good information.
Okay, well let George comment on that. Is there any evidence, George, that technologies have been developed and are being used to control the weather?
Well, there has been intentional weather modification done for a long time, and one of the types of that is what we call cloud seeding. Cloud seeding just involves putting very very small particles into the atmosphere, what are called condensation nuclei, and these small particles enable condensation to occur more readily, and they can cause more rain or more snow than in the absence of those, especially in places that don't have enough of these nuclei. There's been a lot of work done in suppressing fog from airports by spraying propane, for example, into fog, and that tends to cause drops to coalesce. And there have been many attempts made to suppress hail. There was even a big study in the 70s and 80s called Project Storm Fury that was attempting to seed hurricane clouds and weaken hurricanes, and it didn't work. The hurricanes were just too big. So there have been a lot of attempts to intentionally modify the weather. I think it's clear that we are able to unintentionally modify the weather. For example, we know that in and around cities it's warmer than it is in the countryside, and that warmer air tends to rise more readily. So often, near or just downwind of a city, you get wetter areas than you do out in the country because of this rising air. So that urban effect happens. The other question, though, and I think the one that your caller was really referring to, has to do with speculation. I'd call it speculation on the part of a lot of people that there is experimentation being done by, for example, Russia and the U.S. to modify the weather and to its detriment for other countries. I know there was speculation in the 80s when the Russians were having the problems with their wheat harvest that the U.S. was somehow affecting that by changing the weather using electromagnetic impulses or something like that. There have also been some books written on a project called the HAARP Project, H-A-A-R-P, and that's a legitimate atmospheric program. It stands for the High-Altitude Atmospheric Research Program, and it was one that was studying the upper parts of the atmosphere, the ionosphere, for example. And a number of people have suggested that part of this involved experimentation to significantly affect the weather by affecting the upper atmosphere. I know that on shows such as Coast to Coast AM, that subject comes up a lot, as does the subject of chemtrails, and all suggests a rather sinister intentional weather modification, and I have been unable to verify that that really happens. I hear reports of that and rumors of that quite often, but whether or not that really exists and is being done in that sinister way is beyond my knowledge and my expertise.
Gentlemen, one more comment.
Okay. Hello?
The project is called Project Cloverleaf. This is what A.C. Griffith was talking about. And I believe it was on Monday or Tuesday show, and he has a link there that ties it to the whole program. He got deep inside this program, and it is used for weather modification and weather control. It's very interesting, and I think if you want a source, he would be the one to do some research on it. And he just came out with this because he says people should know about it. He says it's a very dangerous technology that's being used right now. And up here in northern Michigan, I've been following the weather for a long time because I work outdoors, and they have been doing something with their weather, especially with the chemtrails. I mean, they just can cloud the sky over in 3 hours. So Project Cloverleaf and A.C. Griffith.
Okay, thank you.
You bet.
Peter, are you still there?
Sorry about that. We lost the connection here. At least I lost it momentarily. Well, John, thank you for your call. George, do we still have you there?
I'm back. Yeah, I was gone for a minute, but I came back.
I was too. I don't know what happened. Internet isn't perfect yet, of course. But well, anyway, those are interesting comments to look at. But let's get back to what we do know, what you were talking about, the variations in the temperature trends of, if I'm not misspeaking here, roughly 20 to 30 years, we have a trend of heating and then a trend of cooling and then heating. Is that a rough or fair assessment of what's been observed in the last century?
Yeah, the distinct periods in the last 100 years have lasted 25 to 30 years each. And with generally cooler and warmer, and they do coincide with some other kinds of natural cycles. In fact, to me one of the keys in being able to identify the influence of natural variations is are there things that you can identify that have varied in the same way as temperature has that makes sense. You know, CO2 matches in some cases. It certainly correlates with temperature from the mid-70s to the late 90s, but are there other things that vary in the same way? And my answer is yes, there are, and the two biggest are the tropical Pacific and solar cycles. The tropical Pacific, which includes the so-called El Niño or the El Niño Southern Oscillation, really dominates world weather and climate. The tropical Pacific is the single largest source of heat to the atmosphere from any terrestrial source. There's more heat that comes out of the tropical Pacific, and as a result, it tends to dominate world weather and climate. When we have an El Niño, or now we're moving into a La Niña, it tends to affect climate in literally every continent, and with weather extremes for the most part, some places warmer, some cooler, some wetter, some drier, but it has a huge effect. And one of the things that we found, and we've only really been studying this systematically for about 10 years, is that there are variations in El Niño and La Niña over periods of multiple decades that really do suggest this kind of a trend.
Okay, George, well, music tells us we have a commercial. Okay, well, hold that thought. Folks, we'll be right back here with George Taylor in just a minute. Stay with us.
Stand up and be counted. Catholic priest calls for Christians to resist Bush's impending unjust attack against Iran. George W. Bush lied to the world to get the backing of the American people to attack Iraq. Now he is lying to the world to get the backing of the American people to attack Iran. But Catholic and Protestant clergy have failed miserably to come out publicly against the upcoming unjust attack of Iran. Therefore, the lay Catholics and Protestants should demand of their respective clergies to take a righteous public stand against this upcoming Iranian unjust war. Each one of us will render to God a strict account of what each of us did to stop these diabolical tyrants, like George W. Bush, who, as roaring lions, go about the world seeking whom to murder. For additional facts concerning this upcoming Iranian unjust war, order the one-hour lecture by Father John Martinez entitled Stand Up and Be Counted. Just go to www.republicbroadcasting.org and click on the web banner for more information and ordering.
Wow, that coffee smells really good.
Hey, it's terrific, and it's healthy.
Healthy coffee. How does it taste?
Well, since healthy coffee blends are pre-brewed from organic Arabica beans, they're delicious.
Gosh, I had no idea coffee could be healthy.
Yeah, this coffee boosts your immunity, has 165 antioxidants for all kinds of health benefits. Plus, it gives you energy without a lot of caffeine. And since you're a big coffee drinker, I thought, well, maybe you'd want to know about it.
It sounds great, but how much does it cost?
Well, not much at all, really. A whole lot less than we've been paying for ordinary coffee at the coffee shop.
Wow, I'd love to try it, and I bet everyone at the office would, too. Where do I get some?
Just call toll-free, 866-222-3017. Or you can go to coffeeking.biz. Ask for a sample when you're there, or get set up as a preferred customer with a 25% discount. I did.
Okay, that's toll-free, 866-222-3017, or coffeeking.biz. I'll do it now. Thanks.
PersonAlarms.com has all your self-defense needs. Check out our cell phone stun gun. Excellent protection from would-be attackers. It truly looks like a real cell phone. Also, check out our new electronic barking dog alarm. Containing microwave technology, this electronic watchdog sees through walls. The electronic barking dog alarm works when an intruder comes within 15 feet. The barking dog alarm will begin barking like a true-to-life angry German Shepherd. The closer the intruder comes, the more frequent and more threatening the barking becomes. You can purchase stun guns, stun batons, pepper spray, telephone voice changers, martial arts instructional DVDs, and the same tasers that you have seen the police use on TV and more at www.personalarms.com. That's www.personalarms.com. Or call 1-201-641-1442. Come visit us, personalarms.com. Don't be afraid anymore. Receive a free pepper spray by mentioning RBN when you place your online order. We will not sell items prohibited by any state, county, or law.
Okay, we're back. Thanks for tuning in to the Peter Mac Show. My special guest with me today is George Taylor, state climatologist for the state of Oregon. George, you were just talking about the tropical Pacific as the single largest terrestrial source of heat. What exactly is that? Is that just an area in the tropical area of the Pacific that produces heat, or could you describe it a little more?
Well, sure. Heat is liberated from water much faster and much more readily than it is from the land. So there's more heat that comes out of warm water, especially, than there is that comes out of warm land. The Pacific is the biggest body of water, the largest of the oceans by far, and there's a very large area in the tropical Pacific that's very warm, and heat is emitted from that. There's enough heat from that it does tend to dominate world weather patterns, and changes in the tropical Pacific tend to cause changes in weather patterns globally. We know that, for example, the El Nino events tend to have very profound effects on places throughout the Pacific Rim. They tend to cause drought in the southern U.S. and in the northern U.S. and high levels of rain in the southern U.S. They tend to cause drought in Australia. They tend to suppress hurricanes in the Atlantic. They do a lot of things. And the flip side of El Nino, the La Nina, has just the opposite effect. It tends to be wet in the northern states, dry in the southern states. Tends to not suppress hurricanes and so on. So they have very, very profound effects on weather and climate. And over the course of time, El Nino and La Nina events happen about as often as each other. But you have these periods of 20 to 25 years that tend to be dominated by one mode or the other. For example, from about 1920 to 1945, there was a period with a lot of El Nino events, very few La Ninas. And I think that's a big reason why temperatures warmed so much in the U.S. We were in an El Nino-dominated period, which tends to be warmer in the U.S. From the late 40s through the mid-70s, we were in a La Nina-dominated period. It tended to be a much cooler period in the U.S. It tended to have frozen lakes for young Peter to skate on when he was a boy.
Right.
And it was a period with a lot of Atlantic hurricanes. In fact, from the mid 70s to the mid 90s, we were back in a mostly El Nino dominated period. It was much warmer in the U.S. There were a lot milder winters, and it was actually a rather quiet period for Atlantic hurricanes. And not coincidentally, there was a lot of development along the Gulf Coast and the southeast coast of the U.S. And I think people were lulled into a false sense of security. And then in the mid-90s, things switched back again. And since then, we've been in a period with a lot more La Niñas than in the previous 20 years. And we had one big El Nino in 98, but we've had several La Niñas. And what do you know? The climate's changed, too. There are more hurricanes again, and temperatures and precipitation patterns have changed. The point is that these periods of 20 to 25 years with either mostly El Nino or mostly La Nina periods, I think, tend to have a dominant effect on the climate system. And in fact, they really explain these temperature variations over the last 100 years in the U.S. and globally.
So El Nino is a warming and La Nina is a cooling?
Well, El Nino and La Nina are both shifts of warm water in the Pacific to different parts. During an El Nino, the eastern Pacific tends to warm up, and the western Pacific tends to cool off. The western Pacific is generally much warmer than the eastern Pacific, and there's a big difference in temperatures east and west. Okay. But during an El Nino, the cool eastern Pacific tends to warm up, and the very warm western Pacific tends to cool off, and you get a more uniform temperature spread across the Pacific. Basically, it's a shift of where that moisture originates, and it's a shift in wind patterns. And for various reasons, it affects things like the jet stream, which affects us. It's a really complicated phenomenon. But we can watch it happening and kind of predict how it's going to affect weather because it does in a very profound way. During a La Nina, the normally warm water in the western Pacific out near Indonesia tends to get even warmer. And the normally cool water off South America gets even cooler. So you get this concentrated area of very, very warm water in the western Pacific, and that has its own effects, like the domino effect, in different parts of the world in different ways.
Okay. So these two changes, El Nino and La Nina, account for most of the changes that we occur, these 25 to 30 year long cycles, in your opinion, is that right?
I think they have a really big effect. Most is a good adjective to use. I think that they certainly tend to have a dominant multi-decadal effect as well as a short-term effect. If you look back at say the last 25 years, you see years which are very warm and years which are rather cool, and the warm years by and large are El Nino years, and the cool years are La Nina years. If you get a volcanic eruption, that tends to cool the atmosphere. So sometimes a volcanic eruption like Pinatubo in '92 can mask what would otherwise have been a very warm year, because the effects of volcanoes is generally one of cooling. It tends to put a lot of dust in the atmosphere, which reflects sunlight and tends to cool temperatures. So the combination of El Nino, La Nina, and volcanoes explains a great deal of the variation that we see.
We'll be right back in just a minute with George Taylor. Stay with us.
You You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Hi, Steve Shank, Fearless Task Force. Sure, you've got a mortgage and credit cards. Your debt creation is probably the smartest thing you've ever done. How would it be to find $75,000, $150,000, $200,000 or more you never knew you had? Now the task force has strategies to make these debts into virtual savings accounts. Ben Franklin said, a penny saved is a penny earned. By doing nothing more than you're doing right now, because you've used your credit, the right strategies can make the debt part of your financial life the smartest thing you've ever done. Oh, by the way, your strategies cost you nothing out of pocket. Go ahead and check out the debt elimination scams if you'd like to. You wouldn't take money from a loan shark, so you may not want to give your money to a debt shark. For an understanding of what a financial genius you truly are, call 800-409-5633. On the web, mydebtfreepath.com. 800-409-5633.
In the United States, it is now estimated that over 90% of family income is now being used to pay back consumer debt. Because of financial problems, mostly from credit card debt, approximately one in four families struggle to pay bills on even basic necessities such as mortgage, food, and utilities. And with millions of people desperately searching for a fresh start, North American Educational Services is here to help you regain your financial independence. We are very proud that the Debt Relief Educational Services Program has helped over 8,100 families nationwide since 1998, eliminating over $215 million of credit card debt, and still counting, and enabled clients to stop monthly payments immediately. The NAES program is unique, designed to help you, the consumer, not your creditors. To take back your financial freedom, call 1-888-245-7097. That's 1-888-245-7097. Or visit www.integritydebtoptions.com.
Are you paying exorbitant amounts of interest to your mortgage lender? We as Americans have been led down a path of paying excessive amounts of interest to the lending institutions. Stop paying tens of thousands of dollars in mortgage interest and start saving. Our financial experts have spent 2 years and about $2 million on a revolutionary interest reduction solution that will show you how to pay off 100% of your mortgage and other debt in as little as 8 to 11 years with no change to your current lifestyle or spending habits. No increase to your monthly mortgage payments, no refinancing, and no out-of-pocket expense. That's right. Take 19 to 22 years off your 30-year mortgage. This is not a bi-weekly payment program or a debt roll-down program. It's much more. Sound too good to be true? Find out just how good. Visit interestreductionsolutions.com or call 1-800-281-5094. That's 1-800-281-5094. Ask about our free DVD and financial analysis report.
Okay, welcome back to the Peter Mac Show. Thanks for tuning in. My special guest is George Taylor, state climatologist with the state of Oregon. George, why don't we take another call here? This might be a good point, and then we can get back and discuss the other source of heat, which are changes, which is solar cycles, okay?
Okay.
Dwayne, go ahead. Dwayne from Tennessee, you're on the Peter Mac Show.
Sir, I'd like to ask Mr. Taylor if he can explain why that as a child, I'm 53 now, but, you know, child, teenage years and all there, that when a jet flew over there, there's a little short contrail back behind it there that kind of evaporated as the airplane went. And now they make these trails that goes from horizon to horizon there. And I'd like to hear somebody that that maybe understands what kind of, if there's been any changes to the upper atmosphere or whatever you call the layer of the atmosphere that the planes fly in. If there's been any changes up there that caused that, and I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, thank you, Dwayne.
Well, Dwayne, that's a question that comes up a lot, and as a state climatologist for Oregon, I get a lot of requests for information from people, and a question related to what you asked about, and the previous caller talked about the concept of chemtrails, is one that comes up quite often, and I guess the short answer is there's a lot that I don't know. But I have studied enough to know that there have been some changes, and certainly one of them is that aircraft tend to be a lot bigger than they used to be, and the bigger they are, the more emissions that they will have, and certainly one of the
components of the emissions is water, and it's that water condensing as it hits the cool in the upper atmosphere that tends to cause the condensation trails. Here in the Northwest, because of the humidity in the upper atmosphere, we tend to get a lot of long-lasting contrails, and it's actually rather rare for us to have conditions that are such that the contrails don't form. So there are some day-to-day weather changes that can explain at least part of the difference. The other thing, of course, is that there are a lot more aircraft flying now than there were when Dwayne was a kid and when Peter and George were kids, and they're flying higher up too. So you're really talking about three or four different things that have changed a lot since we were kids. I grew up in the 50s. I was born in 1947, so I grew up in the 50s, and most air travel then was on propeller planes, which were much lower in altitude, and so the advance of jets and then big jets, wide-body jets, has changed a lot of things. I know that there is a popular conspiracy theory that suggests that these trails are being left intentionally, and there are some people that describe these chemtrails and say, well, they're accidental, but they're having a huge effect on climate. And I really don't have any evidence that would either verify or deny those claims. I think that those are things that are beyond anything that I really know and understand. So sorry, I can't fully answer it, Dwayne.
Okay. Well, anyway, the focus of our show is more on general climate change. But let me just remind listeners, if you want to call in, if you have some questions, those are fine. Our phone number here is area code 800. It's a toll-free call, of course, 800-313-9443. Again, 800-313-9443. Okay, so the tropical Pacific is this area, obviously, in the tropical region of the Pacific Ocean, which undergoes changes which produce El Niñas and La Niñas and cause changes in the climate even more rapidly or more frequently than these 25 to 30-year cyclic periods. But what is the cause of that? I presume that's caused by the sun, or is there another source of...
The multi-decadal cycles, you mean?
Well,
or the El Niños and La Niñas.
Well, if the changes in you mentioned the fact that there can be changes. I don't remember which is El Niño and La Niña, but if the Eastern Pacific could be warm at one time and the Western cool, or the temperatures could be more equal. What is the cause of that?
Well, you know, there's a lot of speculation about that, and I think the short answer there is we still don't know. And let me put this into a historical perspective. El Niños were first identified in about 1920 by a fellow named Gilbert Walker, who was the butt of a lot of jokes. He came up with this concept and was basically rejected by pretty much the entire scientific community, who said he was crazy. Mm-hmm. Until the late 50s, when during the first global measurement period of ocean and atmosphere, the International Geophysical Year, it happened to coincide with what we now call an El Niño event in the Pacific, and so his theories were verified. They were studied by some researchers, but it wasn't until the big El Niño of 1982-83 that caused devastating weather and climate throughout the world that the scientific community really got serious about studying this phenomenon. So we've been really studying it systematically for a little over 20 years. We've seen some big changes in our understanding, but there's a lot that we don't know. And in fact, one of the proofs of that is we're still not very good at predicting these things in advance. We know that the trade winds are connected with this, because trade winds tend to cause current changes and appear to be responsible in many cases for the startup of an El Niño or the end of an El Niño, but we don't really fully understand what causes the trade winds to change. So there's this really complicated set of cause and effect relationships that we're beginning to understand, but I think we have a long way to go before we really know what causes El Niño and La Niña to change. Once we really understand that, I think we'll get better at predicting it in advance, but right now our prediction skill is pretty poor.
Well, and if that's the case with regard to natural phenomena that contribute to climate change, then it would also suggest that we're not very good at understanding to what degree, even if there is some human activity causes those changes, right?
Oh, absolutely right, Peter. And in fact, this is one of the things that causes me to be pretty cautious about a lot of things. There have been so many cases where science, not just climate science, but other science, has been wrong about something that one of the things that kind of keeps me humble, I think, is realizing that the theories and the ideas that I have right now may prove to be totally wrong. I already said I'm a minimalist when it comes to the human influence on global warming, and I may be wrong. I'm hoping that I keep an open mind about it, and if the facts change, then I'll change my mind along with it, and I reserve the right to change my mind because I think that's the best tradition of science. But I think the thing that is mostly used to assess and to predict human impacts are the large-scale models known as GCMs, which stands for Global Circulation Models, and these are computer models very similar to what we use for weather prediction, and they are run for periods of decades or centuries, and they are used to predict future trends. Basically, they are a numerical simulation of the atmosphere and the ocean system, and my feeling is that the atmosphere and the ocean are so complicated that it's a very, very difficult thing to have a valid simulation that would really replicate the kinds of changes that really go on. There are a lot of things that we know affect climate that we have a very, very low understanding about, and that's acknowledged by the UN group, the IPCC. They have a chart in their report that lists the things that are called forcings, things that cause climate to change, along with their level of scientific understanding, and most of them have a level of understanding that's very low. Okay. There are a lot of things that we don't understand very well. We know they affect climate, but we don't really know how.
Okay. Let's take another call then. We have Dan from Texas. Go ahead, Dan. You're on the Peter Mac Show.
Hi.
Very quickly,
have either of you read Michael Crichton's State of Fear?
I have not.
I have.
And you say you've read it. Do you find his research? It's a bad James Bond novel, but the guy can't write about killing people like James Bond. He's just not there. But his research is impeccable. Why is that never mentioned when people say, I believe in global warming or I don't believe in global warming? Why doesn't anybody say, look at the millions of dollars Michael Crichton spent in his research and just go read it? It's right there, footnoted and all.
Okay, I'll say a couple things about that. First of all, as far as the book goes, I wasn't that keen on the book itself. I think he's a marvelous writer, but that was not my favorite of his novels. And this is a personal thing, but one of the things that turned me off about it was that he used an awful lot of profanity, and I'm one who doesn't use profanity. So it frankly turned me off a little bit. But having said that, what Crichton did in State of Fear is he had an appendix, a very extensive appendix at the back that had the results of his research. And when I read through that, the first thought was, Michael Crichton somehow got into my computer and has been looking at my data, because what he was suggesting is basically exactly what I've been looking at and saying. So he and I are on the same page when it comes to what we use to assess climate effects and what our results are.
Well, I'm agreeing with what you guys are saying, and I'm agreeing that Michael Crichton doesn't write a very good James Bond novel, but what I'm suggesting also is, it's there. Why don't the global warmest theories on either side read that book, because it's right there in one paperback novel?
Well, I have an answer to that, I think, but I'll get into that maybe in the second half of the show, if you'll stay with us, Dan.
I really don't want to be confrontational, but I'd like for somebody to answer what he's already put together, but I think I got a pretty good answer when I just had a peer review comment that I don't like the way he writes his books, but the information's there. So thank you for letting me just suggest to people that might want to read a bad James novel, The bad James Bond novel, but with really excellent research. There it is in one paperback. I thank you guys for your time.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you. Well, I think you covered, prior to the break at the bottom of the hour, George, the discussion of the tropical Pacific, and then you sort of tied up some loose ends with we really don't know, or climatologists don't really, because of the complexity of the whole global climate and the inadequacy of these global circulation models to really simulate what's going on, we don't fully understand it. In fact, I think you said the understanding's rather low. Could you talk a bit about solar cycles and what degree you think those contribute to these 25 to 30-year cycles of weather, cooling,
sure,
and heating?
Glad to do that. Obviously, the sun is our main energy source, and if that energy source changes somehow, it's going to have effects on Earth. The more we study the sun, we as the scientific community, I'm not a solar physicist, but I know people that are, and I read a lot that solar physicists write. The more we study it, the more complex it turns out to be. And not surprisingly, the Earth is the same way. It's very, very complex. But solar energy changes at a variety of timescales. One of the ones that we've known about for a long time is the sunspot cycle, which is 11 years. It changes a little bit in length, but it's pretty much like clockwork. Every 11 years, we get peaks in sunspots and then low points. Right now, we're at a low point in the sunspot cycle. When there are more sunspots, generally speaking, the sun tends to be hotter. It emits more radiation than when there are fewer sunspots.
Okay.
There are other cycles, though, in the sun. One of them is the sun's magnetic field cycle that it's variable. It lasts from 20 to 27 years. I've felt for a long time that changes in the sun's magnetic field may be one of the contributing factors to this multi-decadal cycle that we see in the Pacific and elsewhere. There is strong evidence for a 90-year cycle, for a 210-year cycle, for a 1,500-year cycle. In fact, my friend Fred Singer has just written a book with Dennis Avery called Unstoppable Global Warming Every 1,500 Years that suggests that the reason for those long-term millennial-scale variations is changes in sunlight. There is strong evidence that during the Little Ice Age in the 1700s and 1800s, that solar radiation was much lower overall than it is now, not just from peak to trough, but the long-term average was much lower. It was a time when the sun was much less bright, and that was a big reason why it was so cold in North America. And Peter, our great grandfathers probably skated on frozen lakes until April or May back then.
Mm-hmm.
So there's evidence that it changes over a variety of scales, and then the really long term cycles, the Milankovitch cycles, are somewhat related to solar energy, but they also have to do with orbital changes. But clearly we have been in a period in the last 70 years or so that was a lot more active than the previous 100 years. In many ways, that's about as far back as we can go and come up with good estimates of sunspots and solar intensity. But all these have to do with what's called direct radiation. So we can measure it with a meter that measures the amount of light, and sometimes that light is stronger than others, but light becomes heat when it hits the Earth's surface. But there's another effect that I think is one of the most exciting developments we've seen in climate science for a long time. The problem with the direct changes in sunlight is that they only really amount to a few tenths of a percent from high to low. So on the one hand, they correlate beautifully with temperature, but the magnitude is such that a lot of people say, well, these tiny changes cannot be responsible for these big changes in temperatures. But there's another effect. It's an indirect effect, and it involves cosmic rays. It's something that we've been looking at for about 5 or 6 years, and a number of scientists have concluded that this is a very important thing. What happens is we're continually being bombarded by cosmic rays. And one of the effects of cosmic rays is to cause water to condense. So if you have cosmic rays, then you can get tiny cloud droplets. Clouds can form, and low clouds tend to reduce temperatures. So generally speaking, the more cosmic rays, the more droplets, the more clouds, the lower the temperature. It turns out that even these subtle changes in sunlight cause changes in cosmic rays. When the sun gets a little bit brighter, it tends to sweep away cosmic rays through the solar wind. And when that happens, it means fewer droplets of water and fewer clouds. Mm. And now as we're looking back at trends in cloud cover, which we know affect temperature in a very profound way, they correlate beautifully with a number of cosmic rays, which also correlate beautifully with changes in solar brightness or lack of brightness. So the idea here is that changes in sunlight affect cosmic rays, which affect clouds, which affect temperature, and the effect seems to be stunning.
Okay. Well, stay with us, folks. We've got a couple of callers on the line. Callers, hold on for you, if you will. We'll get you when we get back from the break. Stay with us.
Wow, that coffee smells really good.
Hey, it's terrific, and it's healthy.
Healthy coffee. How does it taste?
Well, since healthy coffee blends are pre-brewed from organic Arabica beans, they're delicious.
Gosh, I had no idea coffee could be healthy.
Yeah, this coffee boosts your immunity, has 165 antioxidants for all kinds of health benefits. Plus, it gives you energy without a lot of caffeine. And since you're a big coffee drinker, I thought, well, maybe you'd want to know about it.
It sounds great, but how much does it cost?
Well, not much at all, really. A whole lot less than we've been paying for ordinary coffee at the coffee shop.
Wow, I'd love to try it, and I bet everyone at the office would, too. Where do I get some?
Just call toll-free, 866-222-3017, or you can go to coffeeking.biz. Ask for a sample when you're there, or get set up as a preferred customer with a 25% discount. I did.
Okay, that's toll-free, 866-222-3017, or coffeeking.biz. I'll do it now. Thanks.
PersonAlarms.com has all your self-defense needs. Check out our cell phone stun gun. Excellent protection from would-be attackers. It truly looks like a real cell phone. Also, check out our new electronic barking dog alarm. Containing microwave technology, this electronic watchdog sees through walls. The electronic barking dog alarm works when an intruder comes within 15 feet. The barking dog alarm will begin barking like a true-to-life angry German Shepherd. The closer the intruder comes, the more frequent and more threatening the barking becomes. You can purchase stun guns, stun batons, pepper spray, telephone voice changers, martial arts instructional DVDs, and the same tasers that you have seen the police use on TV and more at www.personalarms.com. That's www.personalarms.com. Or call 1-201-641-1442. Come visit us, personalarms.com. Don't be afraid anymore. Receive a free pepper spray by mentioning RBN when you place your online order. We will not sell items prohibited by any state, county, or law.
Are you looking for a one-stop shop to find all your favorite books and videos? Look no further. Northern Voice Bookstore has everything you need. Hundreds of titles, from self-defense, survival, and financial freedom, to history, politics, conspiracy, and everything you need to know about the New World Order. You can order everything you need on the web, 24 hours a day, at northernvoicebookstore.com. Or send $2 for our latest catalog to Northern Voice Bookstore, Post Office Box 281, Wildwood, PA, 15091. Northern Voice Bookstore offers a broad range of different perspectives and believes strongly that the American people need alternative sources of information in order to understand the society they live in today. You won't find a better selection of books or videos anywhere. So make Northern Voice Bookstore your bookstore. Visit us online at northernvoicebookstore.com or send $2 for our latest catalog to Northern Voice Bookstore, P.O. Box 281, Wildwood, PA 15091.
Welcome back to the Peter Mac Show. Thanks for tuning in here to the Republic Broadcasting Network. George, we have three callers on the line, so why don't we get to the first. John in California, go ahead. You're on the Peter Mac Show. John? We have John from California? Okay, I guess we'll go to John in Omaha. Hello, is this John in Omaha?
This is John from California.
Oh, okay, John, we thought we'd missed you. Go ahead, you're on the Peter Mac Show.
Okay, hello again, Peter. Hello, Dr. Taylor. I just started to say this is really a great show. And Dr. Taylor, would you help me out a little bit and comment on the accuracy of these super-duper global circulation models and their accuracy, what you perceive to be their accuracy to predict the long-term changes in sea level as well as changes in temperature and therefore why we should commit, you know, all kinds of money, maybe our financial oblivion to take care of problems that these things seem to predict. Would you address this one particular item? I also read Dr. Fred Singer's book that you cited, and he mentioned in his book, and he also mentioned it on his website. I think it was in 2003 or 2004. This has to do with the whole definition of global warming, and the fact that the surface temperature measurements that have been taken. While they show upward trends in temperature, apparently that's not reflected by the satellite data and the balloon radio sonde temperature measurements. And when he noted this difference on his website, he said that people on the so-called Al Gore side of things, they had a big problem because the global circulation models, all their algorithms with their numerical solutions of differential equations, are all based upon the fact that if the temperature of the surface of the Earth is heating up, then the temperature of the troposphere where the satellites are, those should also be heating up.
Well, John, you raise a really good point, and your first question was about the veracity or the effectiveness of numeric models to assess climate. I think there is a lot of hope that these numeric models can help us to understand climate. I think they teach us a lot right now. I think, frankly, for predicting the future, they leave a lot to be desired because there are a lot of things that we know affect climate. I mentioned El Nino and solar cycles already, and we just don't know how those are going to change in the future. So what the models do is they just kind of leave everything the way it is right now and then say, okay, now let's just change CO2 and see what happens. That's basically what they do, and I think in terms of their ability to forecast the future, they have a long way to go, and maybe we'll never quite get there. I don't have a lot of confidence in the model's forecasting capability, even though I think they're very useful.
Okay. Well, yeah, I was just trying. Yeah, that's fine. And just another question or two, depending on how much time Peter's got. The news that's come out lately, I'm sure you've heard it, both of you heard it, that other planets in the solar system are heating up. Would you comment on that and what possible effect that could be having on the surface temperature measurements that we're getting right now?
Sure. I think the changes that we're seeing on Mars and some of the bigger satellites in the solar system may be indications that this solar radiation changes are really what are driving the changes here on Earth. And,
yeah,
you know, I certainly believe that they are.
Yeah.
But I think to put it in perspective, we really have rather short data sets, and I think they're interesting and they're good indicators in confirming some of the things that I say, but I think that they're not perfect by any means. But I wanted to answer your second question, too. You mentioned that Fred Singer had pointed out that surface temperatures were going up, but the upper air temperatures were not. The upper air temperatures are measured by orbiting polar orbiting satellite. They've been measuring them since 1979.
Correct.
And